Welcome to the Pint and Click podcast. I'm Dave. I'm here with Joel and Tony, and we're here to make recommendations from the staff of the Des Plaines Public Library. We like to recommend books and movies and music and all sorts of things. Today we will be talking about a book, a movie, and a couple of TV shows. We're going to start off with a duo. Joel and I watched Alien Covenant about a week ago. We're both fans of the Alien series. This is the newest one from Ridley Scott. It's a sequel to Prometheus, but not exactly. They kind of made it stand on its own, but it brings back characters from the Prometheus movie. So you kind of probably should have seen that. But if you haven't, you can go into it and you can make sense of most of it. It's very much like Alien, the original Alien, where there's a crew on a colonization ship. They're traveling through space. Some disaster wakes up the crew and they discover a planet nearby and they go to investigate. And what they find there is dangerous and catastrophic, but we'll get to that a bit later. Joel, what did you like about Alien Covenant?
I enjoyed the return to the original script. I thought Prometheus took it in an interesting direction, but once you got to that point where you understood what the movie was about, you started missing the actual alien characteristics, mm-hmm. and this movie brought it back. It's almost, I wouldn't say it's an apology for Prometheus, but it's certainly a response to a lot of the critics of Prometheus. Mm-hmm. I felt that Ridley Scott really wanted to take it up to the next level with that. And also just maybe to reward people who were patient through Prometheus, mm-hmm. as far as waiting for, you know, the alien that everybody knows and loves, mm-hmm. and the life cycle and the terror and the gore and the violence that goes along with these movies. Mm-hmm. So I felt that it also, speaking of which, it to me it had a science fiction feel, but it also had many characteristics of a slasher horror film. Mm-hmm. So I felt that there was a feeling of Ridley Scott wanting to try something new with something that he was familiar with and just pushing it to another level.
I felt like there was a lot more tension in this than there was in Prometheus. I had problems with Prometheus because it was a little inconsistent. Characters acted one way, then acted another. This movie, there's like constant tension, constant fear. The lives of the colonists kind of weigh in the back of your mind the whole time, which is the way the original Alien was. It was all tension. That movie is 100% tension from beginning to end. I didn't like some parts of the new movie, Covenant. I don't want to reveal spoilers at the end, but so Prometheus and Covenant are both kind of a grand overview of this universe Ridley Scott mm-hmm. kind of created with Alien. With the original Alien, it was very simple. There's an alien on board, and it's trying to kill everyone. And that was just not much more to it. Alien 3, same story. There's an alien broken into the facility trying to kill everyone. And Prometheus was very much, there are these engineers, and they've got this grand plan for the universe, and life didn't start as you know it. It was actually something else. Alien Covenant tries to kind of continue that, but it also distanced itself from that. And I thought that was kind of poorly handled. I don't know about you.
Yeah, it wove back and forth between the two. And with Prometheus, more of the what you're supposed to think about as the movie went on was beyond what was happening on the screen. Mm-hmm. It was more just large and in capital letter nouns. Mm-hmm. Whereas Alien Covenant was, you know, it's happening on screen, but then there were echoes back to Prometheus, and it had to take you out of what was happening on screen, and, you know, you had to start using other parts of your brain, too. And it did. The constant switching back and forth, I felt it was a little inconsistent, and it just kind of felt like you were being throttled and broke, you know, mm-hmm. braking and throttling a lot, so.
Yeah, almost like it was two movies. It was a remake of Alien and a sequel to Prometheus, but it would jump back and forth between those two movies as Covenant went on.
Right.
Yeah, so it's a little inconsistent, but it's gorgeous. It's mm-hmm. a beautiful movie to watch. Ridley Scott knows how to make a movie, even if he sometimes, you know, thinks too big. In Prometheus, like, it's still well shot, well timed. It was just barely 2 hours long, as opposed to, I think Prometheus was like 240 or something like that, mm-hmm. something extreme.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I'd recommend it. If you're a big Alien fan, absolutely go see it.
Yeah, if you're tired of aliens, probably not.
I think you can pass by it. I think that's what I said to my friend as we walked out of the theater was, I think I'm done with Alien. I think just as a whole, the Alien versus Predator, even Alien 2, which I love very much. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's surprising. I mean, I didn't really consume any media about this particular one, mm-hmm. but to me it sounds like it would be interesting and that there would be something that it would add to the world of either or, but I guess what you're saying is more of a remix of Prometheus and Alien. It's not mm-hmm. really adding so much to the series. So I don't know. I guess I'm going to have to wait till it comes to the library to get it because it sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm interested. I'm an Alien fan, so I think I'd be interested.
Without revealing, like Dave said, the ending, you head into a movie and you start off at a basic point, and then you have an expectation of where the movie's going and where you want it to go. And this movie didn't take me to where I wanted it to go. It left me feeling there's something more that could have been done.
Yeah.
Than take me in the right direction.
Yeah.
And most of the Alien movies, what fascinated me is the man versus nature. This one had a little bit more of a different theme to it. I won't mention it, but I'll, you know, it's... Sure. So if you are headed out to watch it, just keep that in mind. You know, what kind of theme is this besides a man versus nature?
Yeah, the core conflict is a little bit different than it has been in previous films.
Even though there's more creature feature in this one.
Yeah. So there are surprises in this movie.
It's a slippery slope.
Let's say
yes.
That. The story goes places as the movie wears on. So that's Alien Covenant. It's in theaters now. If you're looking to catch up on the Alien series, we've got all the movies here at the library. Whether the original quadrilogy or the Alien versus Predator trilogy, maybe. I think there were three of those. And then now Prometheus as the start of a new trilogy, maybe.
And I would like to point out Ridley Scott returned to
yes.
the franchise with Prometheus
yes.
after making the original Alien. So uh-huh. there was much hype about that. I thought this one actually came through a little bit better with his return to the franchise.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's good to see those movies again with you know, the pacing and the tension and the shots. The way the film actually looks on screen is gorgeous. So, yeah, check out the Ridley Scott Aliens at least, which would be the first one, as you said, and then Prometheus, and then this one. Thank you, Joel. All right, we'll move on next to Tony. Tony, what do you like to talk about today?
Yeah, I'm sharing a book called The Hero Is You by Kendra Levin. The subtitle is Sharpen Your Focus, Conquer Your Demons, and Become the Writer You Were Born to Be. It is a really fascinating book, a writer's aid book that uses a framework in Joseph Campbell's archetypal hero's journey as a basis for improving your writing and realizing who your, you know, identity is as the hero of your own story. So really, really cool. The exercises in here are very enlightening, I would say. Like, it asks good questions, and I feel like it's going to be different for anyone who reads it that's interested in writing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the author, Kendra Levin, is a certified life coach for writers, and I think she's an editor for, I think it's Penguin Press or something. So she has so much experience working with writers that I think she basically just attacks the questions that you really need to ask. Like, where do you slow down? Are you like a bad editor, or are you bad at getting things on the page, or do you have trouble completing a project? Things like that, like real actual questions. But she puts it in a form that is really entertaining. Like, for example, you know, right in the start of this, you kind of create a character sheet with different attributes and you rank yourself, and then you do a check-in like halfway through the book. And it's like, okay, now that you've like gone through some of these other exercises, do you still rank yourself the same at like your resilience of sticking with the project or
sure.
your eagerness to come up with new ideas and things like that? So it includes a lot of exercises, and the exercises are actually really entertaining, but the also so is the content. So it's almost like you want to read through the whole chapter and then go back and be like, oh, I want to do this exercise, and this one. And like the ideas are so entertaining that I think it's jam-packed with things that I'm planning on going back to, just because like I have a bunch of, you know, bookmarks in there just to like go back and complete some of the exercises that I never got around to because I was interested in the subject. So some of the more interesting chapters, one of them was called like Threshold Guardians, and it's almost like personifying your personal demons. So like if it's procrastination or distraction actually is one of them. She called it like the Hydra. So it's like the many-headed Hydra, like when you chop off one head, two take its place.
Sure.
Yeah.
And really just breaks it down to like two or three common threshold guardians and giving you kind of tactics to work through those monsters. And really it's very goal-oriented too. I mean, it's not just, you know, they're guarding something. They're guarding your path on this kind of singular journey. So I think it's a really like product-oriented book, which is, I think, refreshing, because I think a lot of these kind of self-help books can be just like, oh, this is how you're going to live your life forever. But no, this is like a writer actually has, in a way, she wants you to outline the roadmap to where you're actually going, like right at the start. So
it sounds like it's kind of a modular. Mm-hmm. It's not, you don't have to read the whole thing, and it's just pick out different pieces and work on them at the time, and you can go back and do other stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you could read it as a whole and see it as like this hero's journey where you're like, there's the return, and there are parts of it that you could take just chapter for chapter. Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to use it too, because there are chapters on, for example, like finding the right allies, finding good partners that like help you in your identity as being a creative person or being a writer or that. So yeah, I think it's really good for like self-analysis, but it's also good for if you need to plot your roadmap to the goal, like there's like a chapter on just doing that. So yeah, I recommend it for, yeah, just obviously the effect it's had on me. I've kind of like been reading it on or off for like 6 months or so, and it's just been really interesting. And it's got a lot of inspiration from, you know, other people that write in this type of genre. I mean, I think she was even a student of like Julia Cameron's, whose like famous work of hers was The Artist's Way, that I think is like mentioned across a lot of different kind of artist aids books. So yeah.
So it sounds like it's for writing, but mm-hmm. you also just mentioned the word projects. Could it be used for any sort of goal or any sort of task that you're trying to implement in your life?
I do think so. I think that the character sheet thing I was talking about, where it's giving you these different individual stats based mm-hmm. on your, mm-hmm. I don't know, it's almost like character traits. Like some of them are very specific to writing. So mm-hmm. some of them might be like your actual editing, you know, sure. skills. But aside from that, I mean, some of the examples are really great, like trying to build yourself a personal mentor. In other words, like creating a syllabus of the type of things you should learn and ways in which you can cultivate yourself to become a okay. better. So it can be, cool. can apply yeah. to not just writing as an art form, but other art forms or
okay,
that, probably other skills too.
That kind of half answers my question. I had a question of, is it for any type of writing or is it like specifically for fiction or for, mm-hmm. could, you know, an essayist utilize that for help?
But right,
it sounds
yeah.
like, you know, anybody not even writing could use that.
So. Yeah, I think so. I think so. Because I don't think she gets too specific on whether it's fiction or just a nonfiction book or essayist or something like that. So I would just say, I mean, I know that the library has it, but I had to get my own copy just because I thought, oh man, I'm using this book so much. Like I need other people to get it too. Like other people should be able to read it too. I mean, like I'm keeping this book for months.
It's a mark of a good book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really interesting. And I think like having written and done a lot of these exercises is really kind of cool going back like a few months or several weeks later and being like, oh yeah, I wrote that and that's still true. And it's like a good journal and a good road sign of where I was.
A touchstone to yourself.
Touchstone. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That sounds great, Tony. Mm-hmm. The Hero Is You. What was the author again?
Kendra Levin.
Okay. Is that available at the library?
I believe so. Okay. I mean, I originally got it from here, but it might have been, again, through the consortium system, which okay. I often borrow from because it's...
So Death's Plains patrons can yes. find them. Maybe check mm-hmm. with your local library to see if they have it. But you liked it so much, you bought your own copy.
Correct.
Of it. Yeah. Very good. All right. I'm going to talk about the new Mystery Science Theater 3000. And to do that, we have to talk about the old Mystery Science Theater 3000 a little bit. Yes. If you don't know what it is a TV show that started on public access and made its way to cable, where the objective of the show, I suppose, is to make fun of old or bad movies. And the way they do this is they actually show the movie on the screen, and then there's a little row of seats and a couple of little silhouettes of people actually like pointing and making jokes about the movie as they go. And this is a pastime probably anyone's known. If you watch a movie, it starts to get boring or it starts to get slow or it starts to get ridiculous.
Or terrible.
You make jokes of your own with your friends. Well, these guys do it professionally and they do it for a solid 2-hour movie sometimes or a solid 90 minutes. And they've been doing it for years. And it made its way about to 2000 before it ran out of gas. And they didn't make any more episodes of Mystery Science Theater 3000 until now. Joel Hodgson, the original creator of the original show, who has been kind of in and out and off and on with the show, is back. And he launched a Kickstarter, which made $5.76 million to film 14 episodes of a new show. It's got an all-new cast, it's all new movies, it's all new jokes, and it's available on Netflix. So if you're a fan of the old show, you're probably scared to death. Is the new show funny? Is it any good? Is it this and that? Is it the same old show? I'm here to tell you that it is great. It is the same old show, but made new. The new cast are great. The new writers are funny. It's every bit as quick-witted and esoteric and sardonic as it ever was. And it's on Netflix, so you can go and you can watch all 14 in a row. Or if you're like me, it's like, this is too good. I got to space it out. I'm going to watch one episode this week, then maybe wait a week, watch the other one when I'm good and ready to sit down and enjoy it. So Joel Hodgson is a writer for the new series. He's not on screen. That was a very careful decision that he made. Jonah Ray is the new guy in the satellite, and he's joined by a couple of robots who are puppets, of course. If you know Felicia Day or Patton Oswalt, they're both on the show as bad guys who are sending these movies to be watched. It's a very complicated plot that you need to pay no attention to whatsoever. And it is very much like the old show, both in writing and production. The set is designed to be the old set. Let me say, the old set was just a mess. It was weird stuff glued to the wall and spray painted just to make it look interesting. And the new set is kind of designed to look interesting, designed to look like that old set. Mm-hmm. So the hallway that they go down is still a miniature. The robots are still puppets, all that good stuff. There's, I would assume, very little to no CG. I certainly haven't seen any. The satellite was on fish wire as it moved through space. All that good stuff is back. And I am loving every episode that I watch.
Now, when they choose movies, the bad movies... Mm-hmm. Let me put it this way. I've seen a handful of the old Mystery Science Theater, and I think it really greatly depended on the film that they were given. Are there are some episodes, like, do they stand out as better just because the movie was just so awesome to riff on? You know, or their jokes on the movie were just right on point, or are they just...
So far, I've loved them all. Whether or not they stand the test of time, as some of those old Mystery Science Theater episodes, I've watched upwards of 6, 7, 8 times. Okay. I don't know if every episode of this show is going to stand up that way. Maybe it will, right. Maybe it won't. But Devilfish and Red Zone Cuba, and everyone knows Manos, the Hand of Fate, as some of the classic episodes. Maybe they'll stand up. Maybe they won't. I can't really say right now because I'm just diving into each new one.
Yeah,
I will say that Joel Hodgson was very careful about, like, he went back and read the internet's opinion of the best episodes. These are the best 20 episodes of Mystery Science Theater over whatever it was, 10 years, 15 years of production. These are the ones. And Joel said, all right, I need to find movies exactly like these 20 movies was his intent.
Makes a lot of sense, yeah.
And he found 14 for these new episodes. So maybe he succeeded in that kind of crowdsourced opinion about what makes a good episode. One thing that is bizarre about these movies that I do think makes a good episode is there's a lot of quiet time. There's a lot of pausing, which is bad movie making, but it's great for them to stick in little jokes here and there. Like, sometimes you watch these movies without the commentary and it's just slow and boring. And you're like, who made this? Who thought this was a good idea to stretch out these scenes this long and be this poorly edited? But when you're watching the show, they're making joke after joke after joke. You don't even pick up on the pauses because it's nonstop humor happening.
Nice. They're the same people that did, like, Riff Tracks, right? That was, like, in between. That's like a...
Some of them are. Okay. The guys who did Riff Tracks were later Mystery Science Theater guys and are largely not associated with the new show.
Okay.
Some of them do some cameos for fun. They show up in a couple episodes, but they're not on the writing staff every single day, or they're not in every single episode.
Okay.
This is mainly Joel Hodgson, who was the original creator and was the host for a very long time. He's back as a writer. And then Jonah, who was the new Joel, the new Mike, he recommended guys to Joel. These are writers that I like. These are voice actors that I like that I think that would be good. So he kind of built a new crew for the new episodes. Patton Oswalt was supposed to be a writer, but he ended up being on the show. I think his brother Matt is a writer. Pat Rothfuss showed up to write a couple of jokes, believe it or not, along with Dan Harmon, who we've mentioned on the podcast before, showed up to write a couple of jokes for a couple of episodes. Not a steady writer, but definitely in the room here and there. They really got some fresh blood, some new writers, you know, who loved the original show and knew what they were getting into to make this new show.
Awesome.
So if you're interested in Mystery Science Theater, the new seasons, the new episodes are on Netflix, but we've got plenty of old seasons of the old show here at the library. Let me tell you, you could spend hours and hours watching the collections that we have here at the library. So if you're into that, why don't you come on down and check out Mystery Science Theater 3000, or we'll know it as MST3K as well. Finally, we're going to talk about Twin Peaks. Now, Twin Peaks, like Mystery Science Theater, there is a new season, a new series coming out. That's on Showtime. If you have Showtime, you can watch the new episodes. But we're going to talk about the old show, the original show that was on ABC back in 1991. It was about 30 episodes. There are two seasons, and is currently on Netflix or available on DVD here at the library. It was written by Mark Frost and David Lynch. David Lynch of Blue Velvet fame, of Mulholland Drive, of any other various films that we all know as cult classics or darlings of counterculture, maybe. Something. It's all a little weird. It's all a little off in his movies. And Twin Peaks definitely captures that. It was kind of pitched as, why don't you bring Blue Velvet to television? By one of the producers to David Lynch, and he thought, that's a great idea. Let's start writing episodes. We all watched the pilot to the original series, which is an hour and a half episode. Tony, why don't you break down what happens in that episode for us?
Sure. So it follows the discovery of the body of Laura Palmer, who's wrapped up in plastic on a beach shore, and she's been murdered, and it just causes such a earthquake of emotion and anxiety in this small, you know, Washington town of Twin Peaks. We see it generally not just through the eyes of the high schoolers that knew Laura Palmer, but also Laura Palmer's parents and the local sheriff and deputy of the police force and the FBI agent who came to town, Agent Dale Cooper, who is really the show's main protagonist. But in this pilot episode, he's very much a strange, disruptive force that, that lands on this and this in this town.
Absolutely.
And he's enamored with this town from the bat, but he doesn't really spare them his eccentricities. Well, like, and no one is spared anyone's
The town itself is fascinated by him.
Yeah.
What is going on here? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not only is it a special agent from the FBI, but it's this particular special agent who talks into a microphone to a Diane who he never mentions, you know, outside of Diane, I'm having the greatest, you know, cup of black coffee and cherry pie. So he leaves himself notes like that, personal notes, at the same time as, you know, serious. This is what I'm observing at this time. I'm looking at the body of Laura Palmer and things like this. So it's a clash of cultures in a way, but it's also it's everyday life in this small town. But it's that turned upside down based on the emotion, the raw emotion. That's one of the best things that David Lynch does. He embodies emotions on the screen just really in a very unique and visual and auditory way too. So really, there's just so much to talk about with Twin Peaks. I'm really happy. Like, I think as soon as we started this podcast, I knew I wanted to talk about David Lynch and Twin Peaks. So at the basis of this series is a mystery. They give you a lot of pieces to kind of chew on at the outset in the pilot. So,
and then as the episode goes on, the secrets of the town are revealed seemingly one by one. This person is having an affair with that person. This person is having a conflict with this person.
This person has a history with this person.
Right. And the pilot sets a lot of that up right out of the gate. You know, there are these secrets, there are these animosities, there are these affairs, there are these histories, and you know you're in for a great show. Without a doubt, from the pilot episode. Even it runs an hour and a half, so it's a bit long. And so it takes its time setting up all these relationships and interconnections between all these people of the town of Twin Peaks.
I think the time is well spent in a lot of the shots. They're lingering, as you mentioned, Tony, with the emotion. They're lingering shots of people's reactions to this news or in unique ways. It's not just someone telling someone else this happened. You know, how often do things happen in real life the way that, you know, it happens in the movies? No, it's it's like real life happening. Someone learns the news over their phone and just like that, the scene of the phone is focused on. But it's also aided by the music. The music almost draws out the emotion as well. And there are different themes of almost like what you're supposed to feel in this theme in this particular scene as well.
Yeah, I think you're describing the scene with the mother of Laura Palmer. She discovers on the phone that her daughter has died, and it's amazing, shocking, engrossing, overwhelming emotion in that scene, as it would be in real life. And it was captured so well by this director and this writer and this actress. Like, the mother and the father both reacting differently. They're both in different places at the time. How they react, how the high schoolers react at the school, the principal who has to give the announcement, all of these things are like so engaging in the first maybe half hour, 45 minutes of the show.
And all of this action takes place over the course of one day. And it's amazing how much happens in that one day. But he stays true to that framework.
Yeah, and it's also kind of impressive how there's so many characters. This is like for a TV show that is really just like an hour-long segment, like so 45 minutes is a typical episode.
Right.
That they go through. I think the reason that they can pull off so many characters is just that they, like you were saying, Dave, that there's so many different interrelationships between these characters where like there's like Nadine and Ed Hurley who like somehow, oh, it's because James is their son, but it's like Shelley will go to Ed for support. And that's when we kind of realize like Ed also has like this affair, not with Shelley, but with Shelley's coworker. And it's like, there's all this like interrelationship because it is a small town that they can pull this off that like every single character that's on the screen mm-hmm. has more than a minor role. Like they have some significance, but they're also memorable. Like mm-hmm. there's like Log Lady and there's yeah. people
intensely
like
intensely memorable.
Yeah. Andy, who's like, just like, he's also overwhelmed with emotion, which is just, he just can't take the pictures without bursting into tears, which is like, mm-hmm. it's just it's the signature dark comedy that like, mm-hmm. you know, it is sad, but it's like, you kind of have to look at it from an outside. You have to be like, well, poor Andy, you know?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
once you know that character better from later in the film, it's like, oh, that totally makes sense. Or later in the show.
There are brief moments of humor sprinkled throughout that really help add some depth and perspective to the emotion mm-hmm. as well. I think it was terrific how he's able to put you through the entire range of emotions watching just one episode mm-hmm. And one show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then as we were talking about earlier, Dale Cooper. So he shows up about halfway through the pilot episode. Mm-hmm. And even
abruptly.
Though, yeah. Abruptly, it's just a scene of him in the car talking already. And the show so far has been somber and serious and gut-wrenching and... You know, there's outrage and fear and all these emotions. And then all of a sudden there's Kyle MacLachlan yapping about cherry pie. And you're like, what is this guy? What is going on? And he's the outsider to this town. And he's showing up. And on the one hand, he's very serious about his job. You get the impression that he's very good at his job, that he knows what he's doing. He knows how it works. He's been here before. He's doing it again. He knows how to do it. But then he's so... flippant about, I've got three things to ask you. One, this is a very serious situation. Two, what are the names of these pine trees? And just side by side, he asks these outrageous questions. He's fascinated by details that you don't think they have time for in this town. A woman's been killed. We've been turned upside down and inside out. And he's asking about snowshoe rabbits and cottontail rabbits and, you know, being corrected and the grin on his face to learn something new is
very endearing.
Endearing and a little creepy at the same time. It's very true. Well done. If you're not a fan of Kyle MacLachlan, I can't imagine you're not, anyone who's not, but this is the show. This is the one to watch if you want to see his work.
Another aspect that I enjoyed about the pilot was that there were moments of possible action.
Mm-hmm.
They're staking out, and then the person that they're staking out drives by.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the next scene, they're like, oh, we lost him. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no, like, chase scene, and then, like, something happens. But then the next scene after that is the people that they lost. The story is developing with them. So you can tell that the focus isn't on action. It's more of, like, the developing of a story. It's almost like watching a novel.
Yeah.
You know, you're setting up different character here, different character there. And you just kind of, like, it's all into, like, a slow cooker, like a crock pot with a little bit of Northern Exposure, a little bit of Hitchcock, and a little bit of Young and the Restless. You know, and you kind of, like, let them stew together, and what do you get? But obviously, Lynch definitely is a big stamp on there. You know, his unique perspective of life is etched into this show.
Yeah, I never realized Blue Velvet came first. I had seen most of Twin Peaks and Blue Velvet several times, and I assumed that Twin Peaks was him working it out, working on this style, and then Blue Velvet was like the perfect gem that he had created after he practiced on Twin Peaks. But it's the other way around, actually. Blue Velvet came first, and Twin Peaks was his, let's make it broader, let's make it more characters, let's make it more episodes, let's make it more interconnected and longer and bigger and better than I was able to do in Blue Velvet.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome to see that. And then I did go ahead and I wanted to watch the pilot of the new series and see what it could be. And I'm sure that if you're a fan of it or if you end up finishing Twin Peaks and you feel driven to, you'll probably end up watching the Like, I'm not going to try to sell it or recommend it necessarily because I've only seen one episode. But one of the things I didn't realize is that David Lynch does, like, sound editing on this most recent thing, which is just, like, it adds to the level of, like, calculatedness. I don't know
how particular
he is about what the psychology, what's working on your viewing of the strangeness.
I did have that sense when I was watching the Twin Peaks that the stuff that's on the counter, for instance, in the scene where Laura Palmer's mother is calling to her to come downstairs, mm-hmm. like any typical mother would do in any mm-hmm. typical morning in during school year, mm-hmm. there's a box of Captain Crunch, mm-hmm. and then there's a thing of Quaker Oats. Mm-hmm. And I actually stopped it. And I'm like, I have always thought of Captain Crunch and Quaker Oats. They both had the big blue hats, and that there's like a similarity between the two.
Sure.
And I was just astonished because I knew that wasn't just what was on the counter when they were filming. Like, yeah.
It was placed there meticulously. By a prop designer
exactly.
or Lynch himself or something like that.
And so it made me pay attention to every other set. There's impeccable detail in there.
Yeah.
And it's fun to watch.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if you like a lot of different things, you'll like Twin Peaks. If you like a murder mystery, you'll like Twin Peaks. If you like strong character development, you'll like Twin Peaks. If you like things a little bizarre, a little supernatural, you'll like Twin Peaks. So,
and if you like cherry pie.
If you like damn fine coffee and cherry pie, you might like Twin Peaks as well. So once again, the original show is what we're talking about. That's here on DVD at the library. You can come pick it up, check it out, place a hold, all that good stuff. The new show is on Showtime. They're releasing them one at a time, believe it or not. It's not all at once for a new show, but it's one at a time. But we hear that you'll be able to see all the episodes sometime in September. So if you're like me and you're thinking about laying down $15 for Showtime, maybe wait for September, mm-hmm. lay it down, watch them all at once, and then get out. I got to watch American Gods too somehow. But we'll figure all that out one way or another. All right, so that's going to do it for the Pint and Click podcast. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next time.